Good evening and welcome to Sisters Time, a gender justice program for, by, and about women of the African diaspora. Sisters Time is brought to you by Atlanta's only station for progressive news and information, 89.3 WRFG. I'm Kali Asset Amen. On today's program, we're discussing the role of black anthems in the long struggle for black liberation here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the African diaspora. Shauna L. Redmond is a scholar of the African diaspora, black political cultures, 20th century U.S. social movements and history, and black political culture, in particular, music. She's currently finishing her book entitled Anthem, Movement Cultures and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora. The book tracks the composition, performance, and political usages of black anthems from World War I to the ends of South African apartheid. Dr. Redmond resides in Los Angeles, where she's Assistant Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Welcome to Sisters Time, Shauna Redmond. We had a little bit of mic trouble for just a moment there. I will welcome you again, and let's check that mic.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. That does sound much better. The American Heritage Dictionary offers up a very generic definition of anthem. You know, I had to start there because I said, well, what am I getting into with this interview? And the definition indicates that anthems are hymns of praise, loyalty, or patriotism. Now, there's, of course, quite a lot within that statement with both political overtones and it's hinting at the sacredness of an anthem for those who sing it. Your scholarship really opens up the meaning of the black anthem as an expressive form. What would you say an anthem is?
You're taking me back to my dissertation writing days. My committee was constantly asking me that same question. Well, for my purposes and for the purposes of black American history, black diasporic history, anthems are songs that are employed. They're songs that are used to actually organize black people, the African descended, around various racial and political identities. So I argue that anthems were the songs through which 20th century black political struggle resounded. You are actually able to hear the particularities and contests within the progressive movements for justice in the 20th century through these songs.
You make a wonderful statement in one of your writings that anthems demand something of their listeners. Was that what you're getting at?
Absolutely. Participation in these performances, whether it be through actively engaging as musician or whether it be as listener, absolutely demanded something of those people participating. They demanded, if not agreement with a certain type of political positioning, it demanded engagement with it, that you had to actively participate in some way, politically, racially, socially.
Well, on that note, I think it's timely for us to actually hear a black anthem. I'll start with one of the most well-known. Poet James Weldon Johnson's Lift Every Voice and Sing was written in 1900 for a Lincoln birthday celebration at the segregated Stanton School in Johnson's native Jacksonville, Florida. The song became immensely popular and was passed on among students throughout the South. About 20 years later, the NAACP adopted it as the Negro National Hymn. This performance of the song I'm about to play is performed by the Tennessee State University Choir. Quite a popular song. It has stood the test of time for 100 years. Why do you think Lift Every Voice and Sing stirs such profound emotions within the very souls of black people, something it's done, again, for a very long time?
I think in part because of its roots in Jim Crow America, that it grows out of a series of legal and extra-legal exclusions that were faced by the African descendant in the U.S., and also because the diffusion of the song throughout American culture was, as you mentioned, carried orally. It went from teacher to student within the schools, from teacher to student within the churches. It was something that was carried communally and within the performance practices of the African descended for the first 20, 30 years of its life. So prior to its adoption by the NAACP, which absolutely helped to spread the popularity of the song, it was actually already being used on the ground by people every day. And I think those types of roots are what allow for its staying power.
Just to touch on something you said, I'm reminded of what Amiri Baraka argues in his seminal book, Blues People, where he speaks powerfully about black music as a music that informs us about the evolution of African-American identity and attitude. And similarly, you've argued that anthems have been instrumental in the ways that we construct our identity as a people. Could you perhaps elaborate on that, and maybe if you could also give us a sense of how anthems shape who we are in ways that might be different from how we are affected by music like jazz or Negro spirituals?
Yeah, anthems, I think, again, kind of picking up on the definition that you read earlier, anthems are able to coalesce identity. And this is true across the board, whether you're thinking about the national anthem of the U.S. or you're thinking more specifically about those that I'm discussing in my project on black anthems. They're able to bring people together in conversation, not only around a certain set of ideals or political positions, or in the case of black anthems, around certain racial identities, but also through performance, that it's not just about conversation, it's about the communal performance, the collective performance of these pieces. So in that way, I think anthems serve a particular function, not only within the culture of any national group, but also within the cultures of the marginalized, the oppressed, those individuals who are actually working towards political bids to inclusion or social bids to inclusion with any type of geographic or national body. And I think in that way, they serve a different purpose than more popular musics such as jazz, hip hop, because they actually speak to a political consciousness, a particular type of way in which we see each other. It's not simply how I define and see myself. It's also how I see myself in relation to you, that we are able to collectively negotiate all of those divisions based on gender, sexuality, class, through the performance of these songs. And there's something really powerful then about them within performance.
But now, how have particular songs become anthems? I mean, it sounds as if a composition has to be elevated to the status of anthem. It becomes anthemized, right, as it were, through popular acceptance across all of those categories of groups and individuals. So how do they become anthems?
So a number of the songs that I discuss become anthems through a type of formal adoption. So Lift Every Voice and Sing being adopted by the NAACP. I also talk about Ethiopia, the Land of Our Fathers, which was composed by two men who were members of the Universal Negro Improvement Association under Marcus Garvey. So that becomes an adopted anthem through a formal process. But then you also have songs like Paul Robeson's Old Man River, a song that was generated out of a Broadway musical lineage, but then goes on through his subversion of the lyrics and performance practices to become a transnational anthem in a way that brings into conversation colonial peoples, the laboring masses, all of these various groups, through this individual performance, through this song, Old Man River, are able to develop some type of communion. So this is, in a way, an anthem that comes from a grassroots effort. It's never formally adopted, like Lift Every Voice and Sing, but does a similar work because it's able to bring people into conversation with each other across these complicated divisions.
Earlier in your response, you mentioned the role of these large-scale black protest organizations like the UNIA, like the NAACP. Not that that's the only route to a song becoming institutionalized as an anthem, but these organizations have nonetheless been key. And so in addition to their needing to be an organizational vehicle in some cases that unites people under the banner of a song, clearly people also just need to be hungry for the message.
Sure.
That the anthem expresses, and in that sense, if there isn't a widespread sense of urgency for change or collective affirmation, the anthem won't resonate with the people and with the moment. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of like a make or break condition for a song becoming an anthem?
I think so. I mean, they develop out of particular circumstances, and they're not the same over the course of the 20th century, but they all are politically motivated. They're all used in service of particular political ideologies. They're trying to coalesce people's political energies towards certain shared goals. And I do think that if you track the history of the African descended from their very first presence in the U.S., we can all imagine that there was a constant urgency, a constant need to actually develop methods of responding to the world around them. And so often that response was generated through music, both popular and anthemic, that black music across the spectrum has provided a medium and a vehicle for responding to myriad conditions of inequality. And that's one of the things that excites me most about its study, is that you have an art form that is not only beautiful in its own right, but it speaks to so many different parts of the world around us, that it's this really potent element in discussing politics and identity in these really complicated ways.
I think that's so interesting, that galvanizing power of the anthem. I mean, it is very deeply political on the one hand, but they don't, they're not over particular about a political platform. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a very generalized sense, they are confronting white supremacy as a problem, you know, and so people can be from very different walks of life and political hues within the black community, you know, and still be able to unite under this sort of a generalized purpose that is shared.
Right. And that's one of the tensions within this particular formation of music, is that you have this text that is attempting to bring all black people into conversation, into communion with each other, recognizing that we have all of these differences amongst us that are very, very tangible, very palpable, and things that we want to be discussing, that we need to be discussing. So part of the way in which I actually get at some of those tensions is through the music itself. So for instance, in the anthem for the UNIA Ethiopia, which I mentioned earlier, there's a gender division at measure 18. So if you're looking at the sheet music for this particular piece, there's a moment at which the men lead, right? They have this solo moment where the bass and tenor lines for the male vocalist actually splits apart from the female vocalist. And I argue that it's in that moment that you begin to see some of the tensions arising around the project of nation building. You can see this gender hierarchy even within the sound productions for the UNIA. And many, many scholars have talked about this as a part of the structure of the UNIA. Eula Taylor and others have discussed how gender is so complicated within the production of these social movements. But even in the music itself, you see that there are real divisions that people are grappling with and that people are performing, right? This is a literal performance of gender hierarchy. So it's important that we be really sensitive to those moments, because I think they tell us quite a lot about the political cultures of these organizations and the periods in which they're being developed.
Well, I want to pick up on that gender piece. I have the lyrics from that UNIA anthem right here, and it opens, Ethiopia, thou land of our fathers, thou land where the gods loved to be, as storm cloud at night suddenly gathers, our armies come rushing to thee. We must in the fight be victorious when words are thrust out to gleam. Advance, advance to victory. Let Africa be free. You know, those lyrics from the anthem talk about our fathers, our armies, our thrusting swords. So, at least in this portion of right. the anthem, you say it's got a bifurcated kind of character mm-hmm. about it. You know, it's clearly an expression not only of racial identity and ideology, but also of a certain brand of Black masculinity.
Absolutely.
So, to what extent are, in the works that you've studied, in the anthems that you've studied, to what extent are Black manhood and Black womanhood affirmed differently in the performance of Black anthems?
I think there's quite a difference between the various anthems that I'm looking at, and in part because as I track these songs across the 20th century, there is a difference in the ways in which they're composed. So these first two pieces, the UNIA and the NAACP anthems, are written as four-part pieces. They're developed for large communities of people to sing in concert with one another. My middle 20th century chapters are performed by solo artists. They're Paul Robeson and Nina Simone. So To Be Young, Gifted, and Black is my Black Power anthem for the book. And these are pieces developed for solo performers. And there's a way in which I'm trying to negotiate what it means for an anthem to be delivered by one person. Mm. And again, I think that lends back to the idea of performance as not only something enacted by trained musicians, but that the listener also plays a role, that there is an active engagement on the part of the audience in a certain respect. But I think the gender hierarchy piece is most kind of evident in these pieces where there are different performance directions within the text. And the UNIA one is a very kind of particular and stark example of those divisions. But there are others that happen throughout. So even in those moments of unison in Lift Every Voice and Sing, or in Kosi Sikelel I Africa, which is my final anthem coming from South Africa, even in those moments of unison, if you listen closely, you can still sense that there are differences being articulated. Different punctuation being used in various performances. And so in part, that's why I spend so much time listening. It's not just about doing textual analysis. It's not just about looking at the sheet music, the composition itself. It's about listening to various performances. Because as the Tennessee State performance you played of Lift Every Voice and Sing demonstrates, people play with these pieces. Mm-hmm. They change over time. And that's one of the most dynamic things about Black music and Black dance, for that matter, that each performance will look and sound differently. And so it's really important for me in my work to pay close attention to those and recognize in each moment how gender and class and position are being played off of one another, mm-hmm. being enacted and articulated differently.
And so in those different performance contexts and perform, you know, stylized performances that we see, I mean, obviously, the text itself doesn't change. The lyrics right. don't change. But there is still that improvisational quality about these anthems that is very much intrinsic to Black music,
absolutely.
Wherever it is to be found.
Absolutely. It's that jazz impulse, the improvisation.
We are going to take a short break. You are listening to Sisters Time with Kali Asad Amen. My guest today is Shauna Redman, Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, and we're talking about Black national anthems, songs of conscience, shared identity, and political mobilization. Here's Burning Spear performing the rallying tune, Follow Marcus Garvey.
Why didn't I?
Welcome back to Sisters Time. I'm Kali Asad Amen, speaking with Shauna Redmond, a scholar and author currently completing a book on Black anthems and political mobilization in the 20th century. The song you heard for the break was by Burning Spear, and it was about Marcus Garvey, partly because I could not locate an audio rendition of the Universal Ethiopian Anthem.
Yes.
You've had no such luck either.
I have had no luck with a recorded performance of Ethiopia. So if anyone listening has access, please email the station.
Yes. Call us at 404-523-8989, or you can send an email to info@wrfg.org. This song is an important treasure in the history of Black liberation struggle, and the fact that an audio recording of Universal Ethiopian Anthem is not publicly available, or in many of the archives
right.
that you have done your research in, is a travesty. So please let us know if anybody has access to that song. We spoke a bit earlier of anthems as a unifying force, and even that apparent unity is problematic underneath the surface, as we were also talking about. I mean, there's no homogeneous, fixed, one-sided Black identity. But in what ways do anthems serve as tools of division?
Tools of division. I mean, I think if we think about our national context, those of us living, residing in the United States, I think particularly in times of war, such as we're in right now, we can think about how our national anthem becomes one of those texts, right? It serves to actually unify us in those moments where we are actually quite divided, that we actually are recognizing that there are significant differences between us. We are not all on the same page. We don't all believe in the same type of national formation. And I think that a similar thing is true with Black anthems, although they do not follow the orthodox prescriptions of national anthems. So while a song like Ethiopia, used by Marcus Garvey, was serving, as he put it, as the anthem of the Negro race writ large, there were instances where these anthems were developed as articulations in response to very specific and local events, such as Lift Every Voice and Sing, right, as you mentioned, was written for a celebration of Lincoln's birthday, but became something much, much larger. And so you can see how mobilization around political issues actually serves to develop new types of political cultures, that they are taking songs that were not intended ever to be used as a mass anthem, but making them such because they fit the political need of the communities who perform them. So I do think that Black anthems in that way function very, very differently than the Mersey or the national anthem of the U.S. because they're not offered from the top down. They're not offered by the powerful to instruct the many, many who are less powerful. They are actually generated from the bottom up in most cases, and only become anthems through their usage, through their constant performance and articulation in response to political and economic need.
So speak a little bit more about that. I mean, I really want to needle in on, you know, what makes Black movement anthems different from national anthems of the sort you described, such as the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
I mean, you've suggested that one is top-down while one is more grassroots in its origin, but are there other particular characteristics that help us to differentiate the Black anthem as a particular form of political music?
Well, I think from the musicological element, there's not one type of standard soundscape for Black anthems. They cover various kind of sound terrains and sound very, very differently, are drawing from different musical traditions across the spectrum. But most often, the pieces are actually generated first through an oral tradition, that they are songs that are easily transportable in a certain respect, that they're easy to sing, easy to learn, because they're carried through these oral traditions versus a literate tradition. And some of these authors and performers did not even know how to write music at the moment in which these anthems are being generated. Certainly many of their performers did not have that type of training, so it was important that they sound and function in a certain way musically for their performers. But then in addition to that, I think one of the major things that distinguishes Black anthems from national anthems is, again, their use. That these pieces are being used at labor rallies, they're being used in churches, they're being used at organization functions, and they're being used around the world. These are pieces that are not defined by any national geography. They actually transcend all of these borders, just as they transcend gender, sexual, class divisions. They also transcend national borders in these really powerful ways. And so it really is.
Black anthems in particular
absolutely.
Can do that because they're not sort of tethered
right.
to the territory of the nation state, because Black peoples also
exactly.
are not tethered to a particular nation state.
Exactly.
We are worldwide at this point.
Right. So you have populations using the same text in Angola and Chicago, right? You have all mm-hmm. of these connections that are being built through the performance of these singular sound entities, through the singular songs. So in that way, they don't subscribe to the fictive boundaries of the nation. They subscribe to other types of fictions, right? The fictions of race, right? But a race that was first grounded in political struggle. And I think that's what's so important, because we can talk about imagined communities. We can talk about the ways in which race is constructed. But we also need to understand that people are seeing themselves in conversation with or working in concert with other like-minded people because they face similar political circumstances. And that's where these songs are coming from.
And so it's about a shared political circumstance more so than necessarily having a shared notion of Blackness.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, as you mentioned, Lift Every Voice and Sing could be found in Angola at some point early on in the 20th century. And that's certainly a testament of the capacity of the anthem to travel.
Yes.
But it's not extremely convincing that it's also a testament to a notion of shared Black identity.
Right.
But as you mentioned, I guess that's quite beside the point.
Right. I think it is, and especially considering that particular song, right? It's being adopted by the NAACP, which has always been an interracial organization, right? So to have the Negro National Hymn stemming from this interracial organization is something quite different than thinking about a national anthem which is not being adopted by France or England or any other nation, right? These very kind of staunch divisive positions that nations take with respect to one another, Black anthems are functioning differently in that respect.
Thank you so much for this incredible insight on anthems. I mean, I have a whole new appreciation for their power and for the importance of keeping them alive. And that said, do we have any contemporary anthems?
I always am asked that question. I think it's been interesting the way that the word anthem has been employed within Black popular culture, because you think about a song like Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life, right?
The ghetto anthem.
Exactly. And that, I would argue, is not an anthem in the same way as mine are constituted. I do think we have to really account for the political moment that we're in and think about those songs that are actually addressing some of those conditions. And he is not the first performer that I think of when I think about those types of artists. But I mean, I do kind of carry over into the burgeoning 21st century. Fight the Power by Public Enemy is kind of how I end the book. And I do think there's real potential for there to be anthems generated from Black political mobilizations. But again, it has to come from there. It can't come from a singular artist. It has to come from the people.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Shauna Redmond, for your time and your brilliance. You have an upcoming public event at which you'll be talking more about your work in this area. Give us some details.
I do. I'm currently a visiting scholar at the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University, and I'll be speaking about this work on February 2nd at noon on the Emory campus. And I hope that anyone who's interested will be in contact with me or with the center for more information.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the program with what has been called alternately the African National Anthem and the South African National Anthem, emerging as it has from that country in the south of the continent. The anthem is called Nkosi Sikelele Africa. This beautiful rendition is performed by Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, Lady Smith, Black Mambazo, and others. Until next time, I'm Kali Asset for Sisters Time. Please stay tuned for Woman Speak with Wiata Freeman.